We're going to first just review what we had yesterday a little bit, because some people are here that weren't here, but it'd be fairly brief. We took an overview of the book of Daniel. We talked about some technical details in the first chapter to begin with, but then we went to an overview of the 12 chapters in Daniel. And there are two parts to the 12 chapters, the first six chapters and the second six chapters. The first six are historical, the second set of six are prophetic. And while these six chapters are in sequence time-wise, and these six chapters are in sequence time-wise, there's an overlap between these two segments. That overlap tells us that this is not an artificial division. We really are noticing correctly a division of the two separate parts that were intended by the prophet Daniel who wrote it. Now, there's Daniel going captive into Babylon, and we talked about that a little bit. We talked about, into Babylon. There's a gate from Babylon, by the way, the Ishtar Gate, as I understand. And it was really colorful and very ornate and very nice. So they had very good artistry in those days.
And they have part of that in Chicago.
Yeah,
they do.
They have that.
Is that right?
Yeah,
okay.
You can see that exact thing in Chicago. Yeah,
maybe that's where it's coming from.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, very good. This is Daniel with the first problem that he encountered, a problem of conscience. And that is he wouldn't eat the king's meat because it was offered to idols. And we recognize that yesterday we talked about this. It was a 10-day test on the vegetarian diet that would prove them. So while they were captive as prisoners, there was a test for 10 days. And it reminds you of Revelation when they were cast into prison, the devil shall try you for 10 days. And I think there's a connection between those two. So what we did last night is recognize that everyone, six historical experiences that Daniel went through, whether it's here talking about the prophetically when the dragon of Revelation or the devil would try the church, or whether it's Daniel chapter 2 that talks about the clay and the iron that would rule as the Holy Roman Empire during the Gospel Age. There's the beast of Revelation. Daniel 3 when they were cast into the furnace, and this is talking about the... I think the false prophet that would come next, that image that they had to worship was 60 cubits by 6 cubits, or a number of 66. And I think that's a small picture of the 666 of Revelation. There's the false prophet. So here's the point. The first three episodes in the book of Daniel picture the testing of the church by the dragon, the beast, and the false prophet, the three institutional enemies of the church that appear in the New Testament and Revelation. I'm getting some feedback. Is not too bad? It's okay. Okay, it's fine. I won't complain because he'll turn it down and then I'll have to talk louder. So the next three episodes in the book of Daniel are about Nebuchadnezzar's period of seven times. That's when he wandered as a beast, and seven times passed over him. And that pictures the seven times that would take us to 1914 when the national political institutions of Christendom would begin to be judged. So there's the judgment of the dragon, as it were. And then you go to the next. There's Meni Meni Tekel Upharsin. That's the judgment upon Babylon. So I think that's taken us to the time when papacy and their institutions are judged. And that takes you, of course, to the time of trouble as well. And then finally, Daniel, the sixth chapter, when he was praying unabashed, and he was for that, put into the den of lions, and the two enemies that put him there were the other two presidents that were with him as the three parties at head of the Babylonian administration. And that two-horned power, therefore, I think represents the two-horned beast, the image of the beast that persecutes the church. And finally, well, that's the next part. Well, the enemies got thrown into the den of lions and they were consumed. So, what we have in the six narratives of Daniel, I just took you so quick through it here, it wouldn't be adequate. This is just review. We have the three institutions of Revelation that are against the church, their demise. And it's very orderly, it's very organized, it's sequential, and I think it shows a pattern and an order that shows this is the divine intent. So I think in the six historical prophecies of Daniel, we have a picture of the church with the three institutions that afflict them, and finally the demise of those three institutions. Now we go to the prophetic narrative of Daniel, and we find that in the six chapters, there are a combination of only four actual prophecies. And when you go through Revelation, you find out that, in fact, there are four venues that that the prophet John, the apostle John, is located at when he has his various visions of Revelation. So I think these four prophecies, chapter 7, 8, 9, and then 10, 11, 12, that's the four, kind of link in with symbolically with the four different venues where John the Apostle is when he receives his four basic parts of Revelation. That's it. That was last night. That was last night. Now, only we took 2 hours for last night. Just that. That's it. Now, we did talk about this a little bit. We talked about Jeremiah. I forgot why we got into Jeremiah. But we did.
Because we wanted to.
Because you wanted to. But there was some connection to Daniel. Anyway, Jeremiah had a period of 40 years in which he was a prophet before the judgments began to fall. And that 40 years combines, you know, in this sequential, you know, time frame to 40 years from 1874 to 1914, when Brother Russell, I think, was predicting the coming judgment, and finally it fell in 1914. Yes?
It had to do with the judgments in the book of Daniel. That's what we were talking about.
That's it, the seven times,
right,
taking 1914.
Over to Jeremiah, okay. Expanding on what those judgments were.
That's right. And we had some other suggestions about even the age of Brother Russell may be involved there. Okay. So now, we're ready to go on. Now, if there's anything else you want to look at in that first chapter, you know, we'll do that. But I think what we're going to do today is go on to the thick of the prophecies in Daniel chapter 2 and 7. Now, I'm counting on the fact that all of us here pretty much studied the books of Daniel and the prophecies of Daniel for a long time. So they're not really mysteries to you. And we're going to just presume that we're all kind of understand that the image in Daniel chapter 2 is a picture of four world empires, and we're going to start building from there. But these, you know, if I was giving this, you know, differently, which I've done before, to a group of people that are just fresh to the truth, I handle this totally differently. I have to spend a lot of time on Daniel 2 to explain what it's all about. But we all pretty much are there. So if I say anything, you say, well, I don't understand, give me some evidence for that, well, then do so. This is interactive. If it's not, it will be very boring. So please, let's have it interactive. But there's Daniel chapter 2. Whose dream was this that is recorded in Daniel chapter 2? Nebuchadnezzar's dream, okay. And in Daniel chapter 7, over here we have these beasts. Whose vision was that? That was Daniel's. Daniel's. And so the ranging animals are the way God views things, the way Daniel, God's prophet, saw it. And in Daniel chapter 2, that's the way the Gentiles see it, is a very beautiful, wonderful image of Gentile power. So we have Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and then Rome in the legs. And then we even have the divided kingdom, the two parts of the Roman Empire. And then down here, divided into the 10 toes. Now, those 10 toes and the feet, you remember, were part of iron and part of clay. Now, let's just start there a little bit. We talked about this last night a little. But let me ask you again, what does the iron represent in the 10 toes? Now, I'm going to ask you what the clay represents. What does the iron represent? Governmental power? Civil power? Okay. I think that that's true. And the iron represents the governmental power, just like the iron of Rome represents the government of Rome. So this has the political power. Yes, Jackie?
And one thing about that iron is the fact that it is also a very strong. So there will be some very strong, stable governments, United States, Great Britain. I think maybe Spain might even be a real strong one. Russia, believe it or not, is strong, and Germany. So that iron talks about there will be some real stable, strong governments there.
Okay, it would be very strong government. There's no question about that. Now, the time frame of this, you know, we often say that when this stone strikes this image, let's see now if I have that. Yeah, there we go. We often say that when that stone strikes that image, that's the beginning of the time of trouble. Now, not everybody agrees on that point. Some brethren have the striking of the image at the end at Armageddon when the whole thing falls apart. But most of the brethren think, no, that stone struck the image in 1914. We're going to look at that point of view in a moment. But I just want to mention it here because I think we're already beyond the time today when the judgment has already begun. Now, I see when I stand over here, I'm getting that feedback, right? So I got to be careful about that. So the governments that represent, that are represented in this image, are really historical. They're historically the governments that lasted during the seven times of the Gentiles. Now, were there any empires? Oh, let me ask this question. How many world empires were there? Four, but you say five because you're including Christ's kingdom? Okay, okay. So that means there were no empires before Babylon. Is that correct?
No, Egypt was before Babylon.
Egypt was before, it was somebody else was before Babylon.
Assyria,
yeah. The Assyrian Empire was the strongest empire before the Babylonian. So why aren't they involved in this image of Gentile power? Yes?
They were before Daniel's time.
Okay, they're before Daniel's time. This is prophecy. Jackie?
These are the powers that impacted in God's plan.
Okay, they impacted God's plan. And by impacting God's plan, they're impacting God's people. And who were God's people before we were around? The Jews. So these are the four empires that governed Israel. That's the point. Now, Bill, what was your
point? Yeah,
okay. Now, there was an, like I say, the Assyrian Empire, did they ever impact, I'll use that word, Israel? Yes.
They did, but Israel was not cast off. Yes, they did impact Israel, but Israel was not cast off so long that it would be impossible for them to keep their jubilees until overthrown by Babylon. And it was at that point that God gave the image dream to Nebuchadnezzar. And it's from that point on that it's counting.
Okay, I think that's very good. That's a very good point. Never before were they dragged out of their land and really overthrown totally. Now, there was a time, tell me, there were two parts to the kingdom of Israel, right? The two tribes in the south called Judah. What were the 10 tribes in the north called? Israel. Yeah, because they were the bulk of them. So you had the 10 tribes up here in the north, and then you had, I'm going to draw the Sea of Galilee, and then the Dead Sea and the River Jordan, and there was Jerusalem over there approximately. And that was the capital of the two-tribe kingdom. I don't have that division quite right. It should be down here somewhere. But in the north, who took the 10 tribes in the north captive and desolated that kingdom? Who did that? What empire took the 10 tribes captive? It was not Babylon. Not Babylon.
Assyria.
That's right. And you'll find this in the book of Kings and Chronicles. It'll tell about, in fact, it even gives you the name of the king of Assyria who did this. His name was Sennacherib. Shalmaneser. Shalmaneser was the name of the king that came in and took the 10 tribes away. And then after him came another king of Assyria, and his name was Sennacherib. And he decided he's going to go down to Jerusalem and take the kingdom of Judah. And he took city after city after city after city and finally came to Jerusalem. Who was the king at that time of Israel, of Judah? Hezekiah was. And Hezekiah didn't know what to do. And so the king of Assyria wrote a letter. And he had shouted out in the Hebrew language. He says, don't say that God is going to protect you. God hasn't protected any of the nations before you. You're going to fall. Nobody can resist the might of Assyria. So Hezekiah took that letter, and he went up to the temple of God, and he spread it out before the Lord and prostrated himself and says, Lord, what they're saying is true. Nobody has been able to defend against the might of Assyria. But you really are God. The gods of the other nations are not. You can defend us if you will. So then God sent Isaiah to Hezekiah with a message. He said, I will defend the city. So much so that they will not so much as shoot an arrow into the city. That's how much I will defend you. And that, by the way, is the predicate for the prophecy in Micah 5:5. When the Assyrian enters into our land and treads in our palaces, we'll raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 princes, and they'll waste the land of Assyria and defend Israel. And we use that today for how God's going to protect Israel in the future. I think it's true. I think that whole Sennacherib picture relates to the prophetic vision today. But the point is that Jerusalem never fell to the Assyrian Empire. And because it never did, it's not part of the image. That's the whole point. God's throne at Jerusalem remained unimpeded. And therefore, that image only discusses those 4 national empires that subjected Jerusalem and the throne of the Lord to their political power. Now, we've got that starting in 607 BC and ending in 1914. And I think those dates are correct. I think those are the right dates. Sometimes different brethren have different events that they think started that, but that 2,520 years is correct. Now, what do we have here? 2 separate independent states after the death of Solomon. Okay, so there's Judah, there's Jerusalem, and there's the other 10 tribes. And those are the ones that were taken away by the Assyrian king, but he couldn't overcome Jerusalem. Okay, thank you. Now let's go back to Daniel. So, Babylon was the first one. Now, how do we know that Babylon was the first empire of this image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in Daniel chapter 2? How do we know that, Brother Bill?
Because he says, "Thou art the head of gold."
That's it. He's very explicit about it. Nebuchadnezzar himself was the head of gold. What verse is that you're reading?
38.
Let's read Daniel 2:38. Who can, let's see, do you have it, Jeff, would you?
Wherever the children of men are living, into whose hands he has given the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, and has made you ruler over them all, you are the head of gold.
Thou art the head of gold, okay. Now, can you read the verse just before that, too? I want to see how extensive his empire is described, at least prophetically.
You, O King, King of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given you the kingdom, the power, the strength, and the glory.
So, does this say something about wherever the children of men are, that you rule over them, something like that?
I'm reading New American Standard. Let me go back a little bit.
38.
Yeah, wherever the children of men are living, into whose hands he has given you the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, and has made you ruler over them all, you are the head of gold.
Yeah, go ahead, take it all. Take all this stuff off, if you would. Okay, now I want to ask you this question. When does that text apply? When in Nebuchadnezzar's reign does that text apply that he had given him... Yeah, you have to go over there. When does that text apply that he was the head of gold when it had already begun? I want a year. I want to know when in Nebuchadnezzar's rule. Was it late in his rule when he finally conquered everything? Or was it early, or just when? Do you know? Have any way of knowing when this text applies? No, that's a good. I would say that's reasonable. Go ahead, Jackie.
No, I was going to say 607.
Okay.
When they first took captives of Israel.
Okay. So when in Nebuchadnezzar? I want the year in Nebuchadnezzar's reign when this was applicable. Let's get very specific here. You don't have to give me a date, but when in Nebuchadnezzar's reign? He reigned 43 years. That was a very long reign. When in his year? Yes.
Okay, so I would say after he became a beast, and then he got up and he acknowledged the God of heaven, he was indeed then. I would say it began after
that. When do you get that story? Where are you getting that story from? Which chapter?
Oh, it's not in chapter 2.
It's not. It's in chapter 4. And remember, all these are sequential. So that's I understand the train of logic there. That's a good approach. But this is before then. So it's before that experience. Marvie?
Maybe year 2 they were able, when they got Daniel and his friends and they were eating the
year 2. Okay. Now, Tell me more about that year two. Where are you getting that year two from? Out of your just imagination? Or?
No, that's we discussed that yesterday.
We said that yesterday. Okay. Did that come out of my imagination? Where did we get this from? How do we know it's year
two?
Right. Well, oh, okay. Now we got a positive scripture. I think you're on the right track, Marvie. Let's read chapter 2, verse 1. And we'll find exactly when this occurred. Marvie, do you have that?
Okay. In the second year of his reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His mind was troubled, and he could not sleep. So the king summoned the magicians, enchanters, sorcerers, and astrologers to tell him what he had dreamed. When they came in and stood before the king, he said to them, "I have had a dream that troubles me, and I want to know what it means."
Okay, so it's very clear it's in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar. Now let me ask you this. When did Nebuchadnezzar conquer, I shouldn't use that word. When did Nebuchadnezzar take the city from Zedekiah, destroy the city of Jerusalem, burn the temple, and ultimately take people captive? What year of Nebuchadnezzar was that?
I don't remember the exact year, but I remember reading, checking this out on the internet, and Nebuchadnezzar took control in various stages. In the beginning, he was a very minor king. And then as he conquered more and more, he became a greater and greater king. And so it was actually quite a few years into his reign that he conquered Israel.
Okay. Part of that is true. Part of it is not precise. Well, let's see. But part of that is correct. Yes, go ahead. Stefan?
The third year of Jehoiakim
is when he conquered Israel for the first time.
Right.
And what year of Nebuchadnezzar was that?
Fourth?
No.
Yes. One year off.
Okay, you're remembering bits and fragments from yesterday, from last night. That's all good. But it was actually the accession year of Nebuchadnezzar. Okay, now we'll get into the history a little bit more on this point. But the point I want to make is between the time that Nebuchadnezzar first took Jerusalem, which was in his accession year, the third year of Jehoiakim. How do we know? That's Daniel 1 verse 1. Let's read that again. Daniel 1 verse 1. Marvie, you've got it in front of you? Daniel 1:1.
In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord delivered Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, along with some of the articles from the temple of God. These he carried off to the temple of his God and Babylonia and put in the storehouse, in the treasure house of his God.
Okay. Now, you remember yesterday we talked about the fact that one of the notable prisoners that was taken in this third year of Jehoiakim by Nebuchadnezzar was the person who wrote this book. Who wrote this book? Daniel. He was one. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They all went captive at this time. And remember that we said yesterday that they were trained for 3 years. That was year number one of the training, year number two, and year number three of the training. And therefore, by the third year of the training, now they're ready to be responsible. The second year of Nebuchadnezzar is when he had his vision and this dream, second year of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, historically, we can put a date on that episode. We can put a date on this second year of Nebuchadnezzar, and it happens to be 603 B.C. So let's go back and see when this all began. And if you look back historically, you'll find out that in this year, 607, is when the Babylonian Empire, for the first time in this period of history, crossed the river Euphrates. Now, what's the northern border of the land of Israel as given in the Old Testament? Let's say in Genesis chapter 14 or so, is a description of the land of Israel. What's the northern border of the land of Israel? Not the southern border, not the west, or the up here.
Euphrates.
That's it, it's the Euphrates River. So the Babylon crossed the Euphrates River up here and took three cities across the river Euphrates in this year, 607 B.C. That was before Nebuchadnezzar himself had ascended to the kingship. He was still the agent of his father, Nabopolassar, at that time. That's the first time they crossed into the Holy Land and began their conquest. And by 603 BC, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel says, "You are the head of gold. Not you will be someday. You are. All these lands you have conquered, they are under your control. They are your dominion." This is present tense. And they were. Every single one of those countries had been subjected. Now, there were still rebels to fight here and there. You know, everything was not real smooth. But his empire was secured by that time. How many years did it take between 607 and 603? Well, that would be 4 years for Nebuchadnezzar to conquer all this stuff and be acclaimed as the head of gold by the second year. Now, it wasn't until much later that in the kings of Israel, Zedekiah comes along and his 11th year comes along, and that would be in the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar. Now, let's read about that in the book of Jeremiah. Yes.
What year does that 607? I'm sorry. Which year does that 607 correlate to? You've got it listed like a little bit right there. Okay.
That would be there. Okay. And that's why I say it was before he was even king. He was the commander of the army for his aged father, Nabopolassar. But that's when Babylon first crossed the River Euphrates up here, took three cities across the river. And so they're now in the area that technically is Israel's promised land. And it took them 4 years before finally Daniel says, "You are the head of gold." A fait accompli, yes.
Okay, so if you just go up there, if you say 603, 604, 605,
yes.
Where's 606 going to go?
606 would be right here.
Which would correspond
to...
Wait,
what do we got? 603, 604. Oh, yeah. 606... let's see here now. Let's see. 603 is the second year. Maybe I should need to go back one. Sorry, maybe I drew that wrong. Let's see. Some of this, yeah. This is not spring. Must be something I have to open up. Okay, I'll get that next time. Okay. David, I'm glad you thought that thing through. Okay, that's 4, 3, 2, 1. Let's see. This would be 603, 604, 605, 606. So it would be up here, 607. Okay. But so it was a four-year span. That's what confused me. A four-year span as opposed to parts of 5 years. Yeah, four-year span, yes.
I think you're probably going to get into this a little bit, but you know, you have Jerusalem.
Great, thanks.
Circled with a red dot there.
Yes.
Or the blue dot with the red circle on it, and of course we talked about all these Gentile powers: Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, being they're over Jerusalem, the city Jerusalem, but in 607. Which would correspond to the 2,520 years,
yes,
to 1914. He hasn't quite taken Jerusalem yet.
That's correct. He has not.
Okay. And is there?
We'll get to that.
Because we talked about Assyria now, and Assyria, you know, they took parts of Israel, but they never took Jerusalem.
Exactly. So Assyria doesn't count.
So I'm a little fuzzy on that.
That's all right. That's a good question to ask. Good question. Okay, but it was still a four-year span from the time they crossed to the time that he is pronounced the head of gold. Now, before I get right to that point, Bill, I want to make some more points. And that is that during this time of Israel's kingdom, Israel had a chance to accept the overlordship of Babylon. And Jeremiah told Israel, you know, God told him through Jeremiah, if you will accept this punishment, then it'll be okay with you. Now, how did Zedekiah get the throne? Who put him on the throne? Babylon did. Nebuchadnezzar did. And he required oaths of obedience and fealty in order to be put there. That's why God said, through Jeremiah the prophet, you broke your oath that you gave when you rebelled against the king of Babylon. Because I put the king of Babylon over you, and if you'd only accept your punishment, you would not have to leave your throne. Now, this is interesting to me. If they had only accepted the punishment that had already started, they would never have had to lose their throne and be taken out of the land and be, you know, travesty that way. They would, however, have experienced the overlordship of Babylon. That was part of their punishment. And if they had accepted that, it would be all right. Now, under who was the next king, the next empire after Babylon? That came after Babylon, but the Medo-Persia. Who was the first emperor of that empire? Cyrus. What did Cyrus do for Israel? He sent them back to the land. But were they still under the seven times of Gentile authority? You bet. They still were, but they were back in Jerusalem. You see, if they had been obedient to accept the punishment in the first place, they would never have been able to, required to leave Jerusalem. They would have been under the authority of Babylon, but just as with Persia, they were under the authority of Persia, but they were in their own city. Now, later on, the next empire after Cyrus was, David, Greece, and after Alexander, you had the four horns that came up. We'll talk about that a little bit later. And they ruled, they had dominion over Israel. But during that time, Israel revolted, and they got a little independence for a while. And they had a series of kings called the Maccabees. That's right, the period of the Maccabees. And they were semi-independent. But there's the word semi-independent. They were still really under the authority of the fragments of the Grecian Empire. And then later Rome came in and subjected them, and they're under Rome. They were always a subject people. There were a brief time of semi-independence where they had their kings again. But here's the point. If they had kings during that time, even though they pledged their obedience to another power, that's the way it could have been with Zedekiah. He could have remained king. He could have remained on the throne. The seven times of Gentile authority would have started running. They didn't have to leave their home. Only if they wouldn't accept the punishment would they be taken out of the land, and then, you know, the land would lay desolate. So the desolation of the land is not a feature that was required for the seven times. It's within the seven times. It's part of the seven times. But they could have avoided that if they were just more obedient to take the punishment. So I think the first time the war of conquest began was when they crossed the river Euphrates in 607. And now by 603, he is the head of gold, fait accompli. Now, let's bring that down to the end of the Gentile times and see what impact that makes for us. Now, I think I'm going to erase all of this here because I've finished talking about that. Oh, thank you. And I'll ask you a question again. All of you know the answer to. When did the Gentile times end? 1914. Those numbers are emblazoned on our neurons. They will never leave. Right? We know that one. And the reason that's so emblazoned on anybody that comes from the history of the Bible student movement is because the brethren were looking forward to that year so long, and when it came, something dynamic did happen. You know, the other side of the coin is not everything happened, but the flip side is something did happen. So it was really remarkable. The whole problem is the time of trouble took longer than we thought it would take. Now, even when Brother Russell was ready to finish his course, he wrote a series of forewords to all the volumes. You know that in October, the same month he died in. They're dated. I don't know if he wrote them all then, but that's when he dated and finished them. October 1st. And he said, when he wrote the foreword to the third volume, we still believe that with a year or two or three, let's allow liberality here, all the saints will be beyond the veil, the door will be closed, and the kingdom will come. Didn't happen. But something did happen. The time of trouble did begin when he thought in 1914. It's just that it's taken a lot longer. We're going to look at that time of trouble today when we get to Elijah. But for right now, I just want to ask, if the Gentile times ended in 1914, does that mean Jerusalem was freed in 1914? Was it? Who had control of Jerusalem in 1914? The Ottoman Empire. Who had control of Jerusalem in 1915? the Ottoman Empire still did. Who had control in 1916?
Ottomans.
Still the Ottomans did. And what happened in 1917? The English in November, General Allenby, took Jerusalem and now they're freed. When did World War I end? 1918. In the 11th month? Okay. So now I have a series of five numbers up here, don't I? But how many years did that take?
Four.
That's what confused me up here. Okay, Dave. You got a series of 5 years, but the span is 4 years. Okay. I'm glad you mentioned that, Dave, because otherwise it would just be wrong and be up there. So this is how the world, the 2520 years end. Now let me put another series of dates here. That would be 607, 606, 605, 604, 603. He was declared to be the head of gold. Now guess how many it is between 607 and 1914? You don't have to guess, you already know. How many years was that? 2,520. Okay. And from 603 to 1918? Same. So what happened here was that in a period of 4 years, Jerusalem was subdued and the empire of Nebuchadnezzar took effect. What happened here? In a period of 4 years, Palestine was freed, now in the hands of the British, who said, it's our official policy to make Jerusalem and Palestine a national homeland for the Jewish people. That's pretty remarkable. So I think this four-year span and this four-year span connects, and that's the way the times of the Gentiles are. Bill, you said, well, what about the fact that in 607, Jerusalem hadn't fallen yet? That's true. But in 1914, it hadn't been freed yet. But the parallels really do make sense. Go ahead.
I mean, we're going to get off the track here, but it's on the same kind of thing. So it's 1967. Does that fall into these dates? Because that's when, Israel.
Ask me that when we get to Daniel chapter 8.
Okay.
And we will see 1967 in Daniel chapter 8, but not part of this.
Okay.
Because it is true, Jerusalem was, the old city was in the hands of Israel in 1967. But their statehood was restored even before that. And they had half of the city of Jerusalem at least, So I think this is really the 2520 years of the Gentiles. That's where it is. Starts in a 4 year period, ends in a 4 year period. A very nice parallel. Now you can go even deeper than this if you want. But I won't. That's as far as I'm going to take it just today. That's Daniel chapter 2. But the point I want to emphasize in Daniel chapter 2 is it didn't start in the 11th year of Zedekiah. All the way back here in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, already he's the head of gold, not only in the 18th year. Now, I said it was the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar that he subdued Zedekiah. Let's see that in Jeremiah chapter 52. And this is Jeremiah 52, verse 28. Randy, it looks like you've got it there. Can you read verse 28? Oh, it's not there. I'm sorry. I thought you had that. Jeff, you got it. Yeah,
52:28. These are the people whom Nebuchadnezzar carried away into exile. In the seventh year, 3,023 Jews, 29 in the 18th year.
Oh, okay, let's stop there in the seventh year. No, I didn't. I'm going to mark that seventh year here. Okay. That's when he took. Now, I don't have. This is not proportionate here. I should have it much longer. But this is when, in the seventh year of Nebuchadnezzar, he took the king Jehoiachin. And he took a lot of captives. Now, there was a very famous captive who wrote a book of the Bible that was taken in that year. So, much longer book than Daniel. He's also a prophet. No, he was never taken captive. Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Jeremiah lived during this time too, of course. But he was never taken captive. He finally left of his own accord, but it was Jehoiachin, and that was the captivity of Ezekiel. So when you go through the prophecies of Ezekiel, and every one of those prophecies is dated, that date is the number of years from his captivity, from Ezekiel's captivity. So that's the seventh year captivity. Now let's read the next one.
29 in the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar.
Now that's here. Now that's when Zedekiah went captive. So I'll put Zed. And that's when the temple was burned.
Oh, that's another verse, sorry.
Keep on going.
Reread it. In the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar, 832 persons from Jerusalem.
Yeah. Okay. Keep on going. That's the second time.
All right. Verse 30. In the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried into exile 745 Jewish people.
Uh-huh.
There were 4,600 persons in all.
Okay. Now, there's meaning to those numbers and all that. That's another subject. I won't get into that. So, Daniel went captive back here. That's where I should put number one. There's Daniel. Ezekiel went captive here. That was the second captivity. Zedekiah went here. That was the third captivity. And there was a fourth one that we hardly ever talk about. It was 5 years later. 5 years later, somebody came in and took more prisoners. Now, I thought all the Jews were out of the land when Zedekiah's kingdom ended. So where did he get more prisoners 5 years later? Where do you think they got those prisoners from?
I don't remember the scripture. I have it written down somewhere. The poor people of the land were left in the land.
Where did the poor people of the land go after a while?
I know in archaeology, they've been able to find some of the caves that they were living in. And they even know what they had eaten and how they were living.
They did not have
a very good diet.
Let me ask you this. I mentioned earlier that Zedekiah never went captive. He did leave on his own accord. Where did Jeremiah go when he left of his own accord?
Egypt.
He did. He went to Egypt. He told the people, you don't have to go to Egypt, just stay here, God will protect you. They said, no, we're just afraid. He said, no, God will protect you. And then they said, we're going to Egypt anyway. Come along with us. He said, well, if you're not going, I'll go with you. So they went down to Egypt. And Jeremiah says, right here in Egypt, where you are now, I'm going to cause Nebuchadnezzar to come and capture you here. And I think that's what happened in the 23rd year. I think that was from Egypt. I think they were all fled away from Palestine at that time. There were the poor people of the land that lingered. There's no question. But even them, they left voluntarily to go to Egypt. Now, I can't prove that that was from Egypt. I just think it was. Because I think all the people were taken out here. So this was a long process. There's 1, 2, 3, 4 captivities of Jerusalem, of Israelites by Nebuchadnezzar. So when did it all begin? Well, it all began here, but the campaign really began up here in 607 in a 4-year span, that war of acquisition, in a 4-year span, that war of deliverance. That's the 2520 years. Very strong court of testimony. It abides with every historical fact. You don't have to bend the facts to fit an opinion. Everything works. And the noticeable thing here is that as of the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, he is declared to be the head of gold. Well, notice that 603, he had finished acquisition. And then that corresponds to 1918 when the First World War was over. Gentile times work much better this way than any other way that I'm aware of. And I think that really is the fact. Everything accords and fits and it just makes sense. Okay. So, in other words, then, Babylon really was the head of gold, the first one. And in Daniel chapter 2, it says, after you shall arise another kingdom. Is that other kingdom named in Daniel chapter 2? Is that other kingdom named in Daniel chapter 2? Well, let's look at Daniel 2 and see if there's anybody find a name there for the next kingdom. Verse 39 says, after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and then another third kingdom of brass, which will rule over the whole earth. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron. What are the names of kingdoms 2, 3, and 4? Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. Now, we know that. Is it in Daniel chapter 2? That isn't there. So, maybe we should go then to, let's see. Yeah, Daniel chapter 7. Instead of the head of gold, it's the lion, the bear, the leopard, and the dreadful beast. In Daniel chapter 7, are these kingdoms named for us? They're not. They're not in Daniel chapter 7. They're not named. So are we right or are we wrong? How do we really know for sure? Well, because it just makes sense. Joyce?
Also, by the various kingdoms' own mascots, logos, whatever, they identify themselves. Medo-Persia identified itself as a bear. Greece identified itself as a goat. And Rome didn't need to be identified. It was awful. Everybody thought it was a beast that wasn't part of, you know, part of the ruling administration of Rome realized it was very beastly.
Now, Jim Parkinson has an excellent treatise where he talks about the very thing that Joyce mentioned. He shows that on their own coins they used these animals, at least Greece did, to be this goat, and that on the coins of the Medo-Persian Empire they used a ram. So there's a very intriguing connection. But if we go to chapter 8 of Daniel, we can get even more specific. More specific. Now let's go to, what do we have? That's Daniel chapter 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Aha. Daniel chapter 8. We now are in a time when he's talking about the goat of Greece that's going to conquer the ram of Persia. Now we'll get to Daniel chapter 8 in a while. You know, we're just taking a foregleam here. But I want to read verse 20 and 21 to see if it gives us the names of these kingdoms. Daniel 8:20. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, Daniel 8:20. It says, "The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia."
There's this ram here that's being overcome. Okay.
And then 21, it says, "And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king."
There's that great horn. That would be Alexander conquering the Medo-Persian Empire. So, not only does it all make sense, but we're actually told explicitly by name, the next would be Medo-Persia, and the third one would be Greece. But you have to combine the prophecies, chapter 2, chapter 7, with chapter 8, to get the names. And the last one is not named, but everybody kind of agrees it's the Roman Empire. Now, why isn't it named? Well, we might get into that a little bit later. But everybody agrees the Roman Empire was the biggest empire of all. There's no question historically. So we're pretty sure about this image of Gentile power back here in Daniel chapter 2. We're pretty sure that that was Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. And then Rome just kind of broke apart into the 10 nations of Europe. There were sometimes less, sometimes more, but the number 10 just always kind of applies to them, the 10 toes. Yes.
Brother David, is it significant perhaps? Smith tells us that in a study of Paul's life and the Sanhedrin specifically, he says here that Moses failed to set up a council for Jerusalem, but under the Macedonian supremacy in Palestine, they actually organized the Sanhedrin, which is made up of 24 member council. And I think it's significant that Greece has, in fact, the word Sanhedrin is a Greek word.
Okay, you know, Randy, I actually didn't know that. I didn't know that it was a Greek word, and I didn't know that it was established under the Grecian Empire. That's very informative, very helpful. It is true that Alexander treated the Jewish people with great kindness. Now, on that track, let's just flip over to the book of Zechariah a little bit, scripture I didn't think we'd deal with. But you know, there's a very famous text, Zechariah 9:9, that talks about Jesus riding lowly upon a colt. You know, everybody knows that. It's when Jesus rode into Jerusalem. Let's read that, Zechariah 9:9. And I want to show historically what that really was about. You know, Cyrus was a picture of our Lord Jesus. Cyrus is really a Medo-Persian Empire. And Alexander, apparently, is a picture of Jesus in this text. Let's read Zechariah 9:9. Who's got that? Lydia? No? Sure.
Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout in triumph, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king is coming to you. He is just and endowed with salvation, humble and mounted on a donkey, even on a colt, the foal of a donkey.
Okay, now that's Jesus. It's got to be because Matthew says it was. But if you look back in the first verse and you look at commentaries on this chapter, you'll find that first verse is all about the Grecian invasion in the north of Israel, land of Hamath. And then he comes down to Tyre, and he destroys Tyre, and then he goes down south and destroys the Philistines, and then he comes up to Jerusalem, and he's got blood in his eyes, ready to take Jerusalem. You know the story from Josephus about when Alexander came to Jerusalem to destroy it? You remember who met him at Jerusalem? Jeff, do you remember that?
The high priest.
The high priest.
Yeah.
The high priest says,
he went out
to meet him, yeah. Because what happened was when Alexander was here at the city of Tyre, he sent a message to Jerusalem and says, I need more men. Send me some conscripts. And they said at Jerusalem, sorry, but we have pledged our fealty to the king of Persia. We will not help you. So Alexander says, ooh, just wait till I get to Jerusalem. So when he was finished his campaign down here, he's on his way to Jerusalem, and he's going to really let him have it. And the high priest says, what can I do? So he opens the gates. He comes out with his retinue, and he greets Alexander. And, yes, Jeff?
Wasn't that at the time he was on his way to see the Oracle of Delphi? He was trying to find out if he was a god or not?
Oracle of Delphi would be way back in Greece somewhere, right? Way back in Greece. But let me integrate that, though. When I finish the story, Alexander sees this high priest, and he dismounts from his steed, and he does homage and honor to the priest. And his generals couldn't understand what's going on. And then, according to Josephus, Alexander explains, this is the person that I saw in my dream in Greece when I was contemplating this campaign. So I think maybe that works in this Oracle of Delphi. And, I don't know where the facts are here, but that's what Josephus says. And as a consequence of this, then the high priest opened the book of Daniel and showed Alexander where he was represented in the prophecy. Well, this has got to melt the heart of Alexander. These people actually believe that I'm God sent. And so Alexander treated Jerusalem very kindly. That's Zechariah 9:9. Thy king cometh lowly unto thee, bringing peace, having salvation instead of plunder and pillage and ruin. He's going to bring honor to the city. And he allowed the Jews sacred privileges that nobody else had. He says, in your seventh year, there'll be no taxation. Your priesthood will not be taxed. What I didn't know is that he generated a Sanhedrin, or the Greeks did. This is all very interesting. Now, maybe that was after him. I don't know. But that's I'm glad you mentioned that, Randy. That's fascinating to me. Well, Alexander would live before the Maccabees. That happened a few generations later. But under the Grecian Empire, anyway. Yeah. Okay, so that text is interesting. That whole Zechariah, it's all about Alexander. And as a picture of Jesus and the peace that he would bring to Jerusalem later on. Okay, so now let's see. Where were we? Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome, and then Europe, which is the breakdown of the 10 countries of the Roman Empire. Now, these were various Germanic tribes that came from Germany, spread out over Europe, and each kind of carved out their own country as time went by. That's where the 10 countries of Europe come from. But they were all under Roman administration at one time or the other. Now, we asked what the iron was that was mixed with the clay. Now let's ask, what is the clay that was mixed with the iron? What is that clay? The church. The true church? Okay, the false church that was mixed in with the political empires of Europe. That's right. Now, a clay compared to a stone would be a pretty poor imitation, right? The stone is a picture of Christ and his church. Christ and his church. So I think that stone is the church, and I think the clay is the imitation church. And that was the papal institution. So there's church and state all mixed together. Now, if you want to go even more deep into this, I'll just give you a little thought here. In Daniel chapter 2, where it talks about this, let's read verse 42 and, in fact, 41 through 43. 41 through 43. Let's read those three verses. Yes, Paul? And try to think to yourself very distinctly, which part is being talked about with which part? Okay, let's read those.
Just as you saw that the feet and toes were partly of baked clay and partly of iron, so this will be a divided kingdom. Yet it will have some of the strength of iron in it, even as you saw iron mixed with clay. As the toes were partly iron and partly clay, so this kingdom will be partly strong and partly brittle. And just as you saw the iron mixed with baked clay, so the people will be a mixture and will remain and will not remain united any more than iron mixes with clay.
Oh, let's keep that picture up there. Yeah, that's all right. Yeah, go ahead, keep on. Oh, do you finish it?
Oh, and you want 44?
No. You finished 43, is that right?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Verse 43, King James, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men. Now, he talked about that too much. You get into some pretty indelicate thoughts. But that's what it's telling you. They are going to mingle themselves with the seed of men. I think what it's telling you is the clay represents the false church. It's going to mingle themselves in with the seed of men. Now, in Revelation 17 that we talked about yesterday, how is the false apostate church represented? Revelation 17. How is the apostate church, the false woman, represented?
Harlot.
She's a harlot. She's mixing herself with the seed of men. And I think that's the point here. This is telling you, this is harlotry. Say again. Well, the Jezebel. Okay, earlier in Revelation, that's true. But in chapter 17, she's a harlot and she mingles herself with the seed of men. And I think that's what this is telling us. This is the same as the harlot of Revelation 17. Yes?
Isn't mixing with the seed of men also how they gain control over most of Europe? By the time you get to World War I, most of the families of the ruling families of Europe are all related to
them. They're all intermarried, weren't they?
Yeah.
All interbreeding. And in fact, you know what happens when you interbreed people that are, you know, like us, a little fallen? You accentuate negative characteristics. And so there was a little problem mentally, and there was hemophilia and other things. Yeah. They're the true rich blue bloods, you know? Not so good. Yeah. Paul?
When it goes on, it says, in the time of these kings, is that represented by 10 toes? 10 kingdoms? Or
I think so. I think so. Go ahead and read that next verse. Verse 44.
In the time of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, nor will it be left to another people. It will crush all those kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it will in itself endure forever. So is that the kingdom of Israel as we see it today?
That's a very interesting question. That leads me to the next area I want to talk about. Is that the kingdom of Israel? Well, now I want to ask the question, when was the image smitten? What do you think about the answer to that question? When was the image smitten?
Well, we said 1914.
Okay, 1914. Some brethren think it's still a future. And I want to address that question at this point. Yes.
That was the question I was going to ask. Let's get into that a little more, the scope of, if we say it's 1914, what happens in 1914? And here we are, you know, approaching 2013.
Okay.
2013.
Okay, good question. Paul, it's going to take a while for me to get to your point. But we're headed in that direction, okay? I think it's a very good question to ask. My answer is kind of semi-yes, semi-yes. We'll see when we get there. Yes.
I think that there's another way to look at the image, although I agree that the feet and the toes represent sort of the chronologically the end of these four empires. When you look at how feet are used in scriptures and shoes and all that sort of thing, the feet represent dominion. So I think that it not only shows chronologically, but I think it's saying that the period of dominion has come to an end when the feet are smashed, that the dominion is lost. There's a bunch of examples. For example, in Acts, Paul says that Abraham walked all over the land, and yet he didn't receive so much as a foot of it to stand on. Even the story of Ruth, the loosing of the shoe, taking the shoes off, showing the giving up of inheritance, showing dominion. John the Baptist, I'm not worthy to loose the shoes of the one who comes after me. So those all show the idea of dominion in the feet. So I think a case could be made for 1914 based on the idea that the image represents the period of dominion, and it comes to an end
when the lease of time expires.
Okay, very good. I'm glad you brought up that new dimension. I hadn't brought all that into it, but that is very intriguing. That they don't have a standing after that, as it were. That's very interesting. And this matter of Ruth and her loosing of the shoe and John, those are very good connections. I didn't have those in my mind. Jackie.
Yes, that I was sort of thinking along those lines to agree with 1914. Christ came, so it was essentially over.
Yeah.
But I am one of those that says that the actual into it all is later when it's all brought down.
Certainly the final end of it all is later. There's no question. Armageddon is the final judgment which finally brings the old world to a close. There's no question about that. But let's look, in order to approach this and get back to your question, Brother Paul, I want to look for a moment at the next, at the combination of this with Daniel chapter 7. Now, you know in Daniel chapter 7, you have four beasts, and they represent the same four universal empires, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and Rome. Now, we need to talk about how these differ a little bit and what we learn more from Daniel chapter 7 that we didn't learn from Daniel chapter 2. So let's go to Daniel chapter 7 and let's read the first seven verses that are involved here. And we'll have some running commentary here. And we'll have to get the intervening chapters a little bit later. But chapter 7, starting with verse... Well, let's say 1 through 3. And I know you're not Lydia, I'm sorry. I know your sister lives nearer to me than you, Esther. Yeah. So I called you by the wrong name earlier. I know the difference. Esther, do you have it? Or do you just have the Romanian in front of you?
I have the Romanian in front of me.
Okay. Okay. Then read Daniel 7, 1 through 3.
Daniel 7, 1 to 3. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed. Then he wrote the dream and told some of the matters. Daniel spoke and said, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens drove upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another.
Okay, now skip down to verse 17, and Jackie, you've got it in front of you now. Read verse 17, and I want to find out this question. What do the four beasts represent? Just that one question, verse 17.
These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth.
That's it. One verse tells us we're on the right track here. Nobody really disputes that, but these are four kings. And I think by kings, it means ruling power, stands for the empire. The four empires that we saw in Daniel chapter 2. There's four of them, same number, same ones. It all makes sense. So now let's go back and let's look at each one individually. Verse 4. Jackie, why don't you read verse 4 for us?
Seventh chapter.
Yes.
The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld still the wings thereof were plucked. And it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it.
Okay, now we don't see all of that depicted here, but there's the lion, and had the wings, because it was a fairly rapid acquisition that was involved here with the Babylonian Empire. Now we mentioned here that when basically about 4 years, they took control of everything. So there's a fairly brief and fairly rapid situation involved here. So let's go to the next one, the bear. And Jackie, you're doing good. Why don't you read the next one?
And behold, another beast, a second, like to a bear. And it raised up itself on one side. And it had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh.
Now that's got to be the Medo-Persian Empire, you know, because that's the next one up. What are those three ribs in the mouth of this bear? Yes.
I think that those were the three primary areas that Medo-Persia conquered.
Okay, okay.
Three different directions.
Three different kingdoms that they conquered. Randy, did you have a... Three kingdoms that they subdued. Okay.
What are they?
Well, that's a good question. Which one are they? Dave, what do you got?
Babylon.
Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt.
Babylon, Lydia, and Egypt. I think so. I think those are the three. Now, you all know that... Lydia. That's the way I would spell it. Lydia, right?
Yeah, Lydia.
That's in Turkey. And so I don't know exactly where it is, but here's Turkey. It's up here somewhere. I don't really know where. Maybe it's over here somewhere. I'm not really sure. But that was a big kingdom of power and authority in this area. He had to conquer that first. And then, after that, he went after Babylon. Now, he conquered Lydia in about 540 and then turned his attention back to Babylon. And in 540, he met the armies of Babylon in open conflict at the Battle of Opis, I think it's called, O-P-I-S. And after that, subduing them there, then he went on to the city of Babylon itself. And he took the city of Babylon in 539. This is Cyrus. Okay, what do we got here? There's Lydia. There we go. Thank you. Very resourceful. Thank you for bringing this up. Lydia here, and then Babylon over here. And then it wasn't until sometime later that they took Egypt. Now here's a trick question. When did Cyrus take Egypt? You all got the right answer. He did not. He never took Egypt. It was his son Cambyses who took Egypt. So I wanted to make that point just to show you that this is the sequence in which it occurred. It was his son who took Egypt. And then they did govern Egypt, the Medo-Persian Empire, but not in the days of Cyrus. Yes.
Yeah, chapter 8, verse 4, kind of shows three empires here that were taken. And it reads, "And I saw the ram pushing westward and northward and southward." So those are three areas or directions that the ram, which is the Medo-Persian Empire, and of course the westward one would be Babylon, the northward one would be Lydia, and the southward one would be Egypt.
Okay, very interesting. So if you're over here in Persia, you're coming to Babylon, north here, and then south to here. Very interesting. You know, I never connected those three directions with those three ribs before. That's intriguing to me.
The comments tell us that it's a hardest reading reference for page 48.
Well, what does it say on page 48? Does it have a little X?
Just what it said, three kingdoms it subdued.
Okay.
Which it subdued.
Okay. Three ribs. Three directions. I'm putting these little notes here for myself. Those are things I didn't know about. I'd like to jot down in my notes before I erase that. Yes?
Well, you know, I think there's another interesting point about this, too. In verse 5 here of Daniel 7, it says, "And behold, another beast, a second like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side." And then when you go over to Daniel 8, verse 3, it says, "Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other." And when I look at the, you know, lifted up on one side or the two horns, one was higher than the other, and I don't know if you're going to get to this, but, you know, we have the Medo-Persian Empire, which I think this is a great map here. Well, who do we know today? Persians. It's like the Persians are the higher ones. That's the ones that had dominance. And the Medes we don't even hear about today, you know. I mean, that's like gone. So I think that's another maybe a little tidbit in here in both of these verses.
Okay, now this is very intriguing. As a matter of fact, Cyrus was, let me ask you this question. Was he Median? Was he Persian?
Persian.
He was both. His mother was the daughter of the king of the Medes, and his father was the king of Persia. So he was both. And but so the higher, more powerful kingdom was the Median kingdom, until Cyrus finally subdued a person named Astyages, who was actually his grandfather. And then he put the Persians as supreme over the Medes. And so the higher one came up last. You're right. That's a very good point to bring up here. And now you mentioned about this bear raised itself up on one side. So if Persia was over here and they raised up on one side, it's like all pointing, you know, one direction, not back that away so much, but this away, you know, more. So I think that's interesting too, that one side. Now it says, arise, devour much flesh.
So you're looking at a side being the direction that they went.
I think so.
Instead of what I was saying.
Well, what were you saying? I thought.
The Medes and the Persians are really the ones that were prominent.
The Persian side.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. You know, I didn't piece all that together. Persian side. Okay. I got to jot that down for me too. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so now this bear that eats, devours much flesh. It didn't say that about the Babylonians or the Grecians or the Romans. Medo-Persia was famous for the fact that it just amassed huge armies and just went. Now, I mean, there are some astounding figures of the numbers in their armies. Some people, in Herodotus, the great ancient historian, and some people dispute whether those numbers could possibly be right. But they were huge. I think there was maybe an army of 5 million or something. I have no way positioned to tell you whether that was an exaggerated figure or not. But that characterized the Persian army was just huge masses of people to go out. That's not the Babylonian approach, and it certainly wasn't the Alexander approach. So, but the Medo-Persian Empire, they just went out and crushed their opposition like a bear. There's devour much flesh. I think it has a historical connection. Jeff?
I don't know if you're going to get to this or not, but if you relate then the beast back to the image, the second part of the image was the chest and arms of silver. So you had two arms, like Medo-Persia again.
Yeah.
So you had two arms like Medo-Persia again, and then you had the idea of a chest. I have the idea of crushing that same concept reflected in the image as well.
Very good. Okay, thank you. That's a very good connection. So now the next one, of course, is let's read the next. I forgot to say something about the first one, the lion that had a man's heart given to it, and then stood up on its feet. And I know we all think of a heart as love, you know, but in those days they didn't. That was the seat of thought. It represented the higher approach, the higher, loftier thinking. And it turned out the Babylonian Empire did kind of accentuate in the sciences and mathematics and so forth. What was our number system is base 10, and that's because we have tens of these. That's the way we count them. But the Babylonians used a different base number system. What was their number system? Anybody? 60, that's right. Now, how many minutes in an hour do we have today? 60, that comes from them. How many degrees in a circle? 60 times 6, 360. That comes from them. So there was a lot of things the Babylonians did that we still residual have today. And I think that was telling us the Assyrian Empire wasn't noted for their great academic achievements, but the Babylonian Empire started to have wise men and counselors and mathematicians and they kind of started this. And I think that's represented by standing on your feet and thinking a little bit, having a little bit of more than just, you know, a good sword. Yes.
Also, Nebuchadnezzar acknowledged the God of heaven.
Okay, that's another very good point. Can I have this other diagram back? Now, this is interesting, because Daniel was said, you are the head of gold, and after you shall come another kingdom inferior to you. However, do you still have that map there? Can you switch back and forth? Okay. The Babylonian Empire was this area in checkered area here, but the Medo-Persian Empire was much bigger. So in what sense was it inferior? Well, each one of these, let's go back to the image now, each one of these actually degraded in the respect of how they related to God. Nebuchadnezzar commanded the praise of Jehovah. He commanded people to worship Jehovah. Cyrus, what was his relationship to God? How did he interplay with him? He supported because he said, build the temple of God back in Jerusalem to honor him. So not quite as good as what Nebuchadnezzar did commanding the praise. The Grecian Empire, well, you know, Alexander did okay, but then his successors were the biggest, worst oppressors of Israel up to that point. And you get to Antiochus Epiphanes, he was one of the most brutal dictators of all. And then Rome, Rome broke Israel and crushed them as a nation. So you've got all four of them declining in respect to how they interplayed with the Heavenly Father. That's a very good point. Yes, Randy?
The Philistine people were apparently in ethnological studies show that they are their origins were back in Macedonia.
Okay, that's very interesting. That's just where the Philistines came from. They had some Greek influence among them. Okay, so let's see. Now we talked about the bear. Let's go on to the leopard. And that's in the next verse, Daniel 7, verse 6. Verse 6, and see who can read that for us. Who's got it available? See, Estelle, do you have that?
After that, I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads and was given authority to rule.
Okay, so this leopard is going to be the Grecian Empire. Four wings, well, maybe that shows something about the rapidity of Alexander's conquest. It's like the Babylonians were pretty quick, had wings on them. So this was a very rapid conquest. The Persians, by the way, was not. It took more years, more time, more ponderous movements, so it wasn't characterized that way. The leopard, there's something unusual about this leopard. I haven't seen very many leopards in my life, but I've seen some. And the San Diego Zoo has leopards. This is one I've never seen before. What was unusual about this leopard? Yes.
It had four wings, and it could move real fast and conquer very quickly.
Leopards are quick anyway, but four wings, wow. Something else about this leopard. How many? Four heads. Now, we all have a forehead, but he had four heads. That's quite different. And those four heads have to tell you something about four governments that would ensue from the Grecian Empire. And those are the four generals. You know, I say four generals. One of them was not a general, he's an advisor. But there were four principles of Alexander that took the kingdom, divided the kingdom among them, and became four independent kingdoms. That didn't happen in Babylon, didn't happen to Medo-Persia. It didn't really even happen to Rome. But in the Grecian Empire, it split into four kingdoms. And that's unique. And therefore, it's represented in the prophecy. And last, the great dreadful beast. Yes, David, go ahead.
Also, his four generals, they weren't, as far as I understand, they weren't not blood related. Is that also part of it?
You say not blood related, they're all Greek.
Well, not sons. Were they sons?
No, you're right. They were not related to Alexander. As a matter of fact, when we get to the 11th chapter, it will explicitly tell us that his successor kings were not his son, not his seed, not his lineage. Now, he did have a son, but that son was killed when he was still a boy. And somebody was a regent on his behalf while he was a little bit, but then he says he's in the way, let's dispose of him. So he didn't have any seed that became one of these four heads. That's a very good point. Okay, now the next one, let's read about, what was that beast I saw, that big beast I saw? Okay, okay, very good. There's the four heads of the leopard and the wings. That's a very good image. Very good. Okay, let's go back now. If you got another spectacular image of that, we'll have that. But right now, we'll just look at this. Let's read on about the Roman Empire in verse 7. Cecile, why don't you read that for us, verse 7.
After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth, and it crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns.
Okay. What kind of teeth did it have?
Iron teeth.
Iron. Boy, that kind of reminds me of these iron legs. That's the Roman power. That's the iron. And the ten horns would refer to the ten toes of the image. These are the ten Germanic tribes that spread out over Europe, and Rome had control of them, and then they all became independent powers on their own right. Now, I notice it doesn't say that there were ten heads on this beast. It's ten horns instead, whereas in the Grecian Empire, there are four heads. Maybe that's to suggest that these had a more dominant empire than those ten horns did, something like that. Although, you know, it's hard to be sure. But there we go. There's the ten horns. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I guess it's something like that. Okay. Okay. Now, let's see. You read verse 7. Did you read verse 8? Okay, let's read that. And I'm going to go back.
While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little one, which came up among them, and three of the first horns were uprooted before it. The horn had eyes like the eyes of a man, and the mouth that spoke boastfully.
Okay, now here's another image that's quite popular. We've seen that from time to time. There's the stone ready to strike the image. Here's the four beasts. There's that dreadful beast. He's got ten horns. And if you look careful there, you see this big horn, stout horn that came up there? It's got two eyes and a mouth. And that came up after the ten horns, so it wasn't original. Three of the early horns were plucked up, and this one grew in its stead. Now let's look at a close-up of that horn. Do we have one? There we go. Oh, I'm missing it, sorry. There we go. There's a close-up. There's that horn with eyes because it's wise, and a mouth with bombastic utterances. And that horn is going to be what institution that grows up in Europe and dominates the other horns? Papacy. That's papacy. So that's pretty clear to us. It just, and you know, I've even talked about Daniel in a group actually in a jail with a group of prisoners. And they happen to be, just happens to be, a lot of them were Catholic origin. I'm from San Diego. We have a lot of Hispanics, and they are usually Catholic oriented. And we talk about what happened in the politics of Europe during the gospel, what we call the Gospel Age. And they recognize that it was pretty much ruled by papacy. And that's just historically true. That's all there is to it. Just historically true. They recognize everything papacy did wasn't all that great. And so they really didn't have any problem recognizing this was historically fulfilled. Well, there you go. There's a pretty picture for you. He's uprooting three horns. It's kind of a gory scene. But that's I guess, as good a depiction. Let's go back to that one you had. Okay. Now, I don't know. He's finding these on the Internet as we speak here, I think. But that's one I did not encounter before. That's a pretty good image. Yes.
What are the three horns that were, like, uprooted?
Okay. Those three horns have to be three powers that are uprooted, and there are different opinions on exactly the identification of those three. And I would like to be stable in my own mind exactly which three of those are. Some of them we can pretty much agree on, though. Yes, go ahead.
I'll just throw out Ostrogoths, Visigoths, and Vandals.
Okay. Let's see here.
Which were primarily Germanic tribes with kind of an Irish, Nordic.
Give me those again.
Ostrogoths.
Visigoths.
And the Vandals, V-A-N-D-A-L-S.
Okay. Now, the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths were both Goths. Why are they different? What does Ostro and Visi mean?
Not sure.
Okay, all right. That statement applies to a lot of things. What's that? East and West. Okay. Austro is the East. That's like Ostera or Estera or that's the East. That's the East. I think maybe your name really is like Star or something, right? It's like the beautiful Esther. Yeah, that's right. But Ostera or Ostra is also East. And, but maybe that's a different derivation. But Visi is West. I don't know these languages myself. That's just what I hear people say. So this is, you know, what Roger say? All I know is what I read in the papers. All I know is a few thoughts I read now and then. I don't know about myself. But and the Visigoths have become, I think, like Portugal, something like that, or Spain, Portugal area. The Ostrogoths were a little farther west, and they were inhabited Italy. So that kind of makes sense. The Vandals, where did they inhabit?
North Africa.
North Africa, that's right. Now, the reason that maybe these are attractive to you is because these are three entities that preceded 539 that were uprooted to make way for the papacy. Could be. Isaac Newton had a little different take on it. He thought that maybe one of those three was the Lombards in Italy that were right in Italy where papacy rose, and it took a while after 539 before the Lombards were uprooted. So that was after 539. Others say, no, it's got to be before 539. You know, I'm a little fuzzy on this myself, to be honest. Jackie?
I might be wrong, but Romania, I was thought of put there. Somebody has a hat that's got three little prongs on it. I don't know which nation, but a nation has that. I don't know if it's over in Romania.
Well, now there is the Roman pontiff. The Roman pontiff is supposed to have three crowns, ruler of heaven, earth, and heaven. It was, I forget, three things that he's in charge of, which basically includes everything, and it doesn't include heaven. Okay, here, yes, go ahead. Yeah, this is great, thanks.
I think she might be referring to what's on the Arch of Constantine. If you look on the Arch of Constantine, it's the arch he had built to commemorate his victory at the Milvian Bridge.
Milvian Bridge.
And on that he has these different parts of the empire, and these priests have some kind of special hats that they wear, and they have three horns on those hats.
Okay, well, that's something more. I have to look into that.
So if you zoom in, I don't know if you have enough resolution on those. Go down to the up a little higher. Those circles, in the circles, I think that's where I had seen that before. They wear
somewhere
these special hats.
72 dpi, I think we're not going to see
no.
it. Okay, let's go back to that map. That was interesting. Well, anyway, the ten horns represent the powers of Europe. I think just about everybody thinks that one of those horns was the Ostrogoths, and one of them was... Well, many people think it was. I'm not sure. I don't know one way or the other, to be honest with you. In Volume 3, you have the suggestion that it was the Ostrogoths, the Western Empire, and the Heruli. And, I'd like to figure that out myself as well. All these possibilities look interesting to me.
So how many possibilities are there, then, when we're talking about this? Because I got three threads, and some of them overlap and some don't. Okay, so there's four.
And Lombards. I think everybody, as far as I know, chooses between those five. And if you insist that they're all there, all the three are operated before 539, you would not include the Lombards. Oh, and the Western Empire, I'm sorry. And that was uprooted before the Ostrogoths and the Heruli. But I think in Volume 3, if I'm not mistaken, it's the Western Empire, then the Ostrogoths, and then the Heruli, something like that.
Well, it does mention
yes, go ahead.
The Western Empire.
Yeah, page 76 to 79 does say the Western Empire by the Heruli was one, the Heruli by the Ostrogoths was another, and the Ostrogoths by Justinian on behalf of the papacy, which was the third.
Thank you. I had those out of sequence.
Yeah, so they all had, it says, held the city, Rome, and suburbs of Rome continuously from A.D. 539.
Okay. Now, the problem with the Vandals is that they didn't really have the city of Rome, although they did conquer Rome at one time. That's the whole thing about vandalizing, right? That's when they came in and vandalized Rome. That's the whole point. So I guess that could be too. But yes, go ahead.
Isaac Newton had the Lombards, but the Lombards, I think they were overthrown between 726 and 800.
That's right. That's why so that's after the 539.
And that's why Isaac Newton dates the 1260 from 800 to 2063 or whatever it is.
Well, maybe not, because I have a book where he said we got about 100 years to go. And that would bring you to the end of the 1700s, early 1800s. So I think he looked at a variety of possibilities. Okay, so those are the three in Volume 3, the Western Empire, the Heruli, and the Ostrogoths. Okay, thanks. Anything more on these three horns? Who asked that question? Somebody did?
Gabriel.
Oh, Gabriel. Oh, yeah. Gabriel, I'm sorry, I can't be definitive, but you got some opinions here. Okay, now let's go back to that horn. Let's see. to what I had. Yeah. So there's papacy. And that's the big horn in chapter, let's see, we're in chapter 7. That's in verse 8. Eyes speaking great, a mouth speaking great things. And that's the horn that's going to have authority for a long time. Now, for the first time in Daniel chapter 7, we're going to have a time prophecy. And it's probably the most famous, well-known time prophecy in all of Scripture. And that's the prophecy of the time times and a half. So we get to that. Well, not until we get down to verse 25 and 26. But what we're describing in all of the seventh chapter is these four beasts, and then finally the kingdom of Christ that comes. You'll find that in chapter 7, verse 13. I saw in the night visions, and one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven, came near to the Ancient of Days, and they were given him a kingdom and a dominion and a power and authority. So that's clearly, Mr. Owen? Okay, that's clearly Jesus that's involved. It still seems weak to me. Is it a little weakish?
I was trying to correct the feedback.
Okay. When it's weak, I have to talk louder. That's all. This now I hear myself a little better now. Okay. So, the time prophecy. And this time prophecy of time times and a half. No, before I get there, I know I was talking about Jesus coming to receive power and authority, you know, from the Heavenly Father. Now, up to verse 14, is there any mention of the church, of the saints of the Most High? Up to verse 14, any mention of the saints of the Most High? I don't think there is. There's a mention of Jesus coming to the Ancient of Days to receive his kingdom, but no mention of the church. Now, starting in verse 15 and 16, we see Daniel was quite grieved. Now, Gabriella, would you read for us 15 and 16?
As for me, Daniel, my spirit was grieved in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near unto one of them that stood by and asked him the truth concerning all this. So he told me and made me know the interpretation of the things.
So he just saw the vision. Now he's going to get the interpretation. So everything starting with verse 17 and forward is the interpretation. And in the interpretation, then we have a mention of the saints of the Most High. Now let's go to verse 27. That's a very easy one. Gabriella, would you read that for us as well? 27.
And the kingdom and the dominion and the greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heavens shall be given to the people of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him.
Now, if this is part of the interpretation of the vision, what part of the vision is this interpreting? What verse in verses 1 through 15 is this a comment about? Jackie?
Verse 13.
I think so. That's where Jesus comes and gets a kingdom. What we don't see in that vision is that the saints are part of this. We don't read that until we get to the interpretation. And in the interpretation, we read the saints are also recipients of this kingdom. So that then connects us to Revelation. We'll reign with Christ 1,000 years and all that. So I think that the saints receiving the kingdom and reigning forever and ever is very interesting. I use this scripture a lot, you know, in a public witness, because it's telling you that the church is going to reign over a whole bunch of other people. So there's a whole bunch of other people that are not in the church, but are receiving a blessing by the church. We know the same thing from Revelation 20. They live and reign with Christ 1,000 years. These are so easy texts to use to show that the elect are going to bless the non-elect, that, you know, when I use those, nobody seems to object. Everybody just says, oh, yeah, that seems reasonable. Just a real easy way to prove the kingdom. Paul?
Why are you so sure the holy people here is the church and not Israel?
Okay. Because that's the way I learned it. Now you put me on the spot. Let's see. I think it's because in Daniel chapter 7, and we're going to talk about the 1260 years here. It's talking about, in verse 8, the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom, possess the kingdom forever and ever, and I would know the truth of the fourth beast and how he persecuted the saints. And let's see, that's down here at verse 25. He shall speak great words against the Most High and wear out the saints of the Most High and think to change times and laws. They shall be given into his hand. And even in verse 27, the kingdom, the dominion, the power is given to the saints and they will rule and bless. Paul, to me, that means the church. I don't know, it just seems to read that way to me. I'm going to have Israel involved here somewhere. But I just think prima facie, this is talking about those that rule and reign with Christ. And Israel has lost that privilege. Although many of the Jewish people, of course, did not lose it. Many of them became spiritual and received it. Jackie?
I would say also verse 13, it said that he gained access to the Ancient of Days. He was up in heaven. And we know that the Jews would have rulership on the earth. So as a nation, so these, whoever these are with him in 13 and 14, they're with, up there with the Ancient of Days.
Okay.
In heaven.
Jeff?
Also in Revelation chapter 20, a lot of that chapter is picked up, I believe, from this chapter in Daniel. It talks about the books being opened, the throne scene, all of that. And earlier in the chapter, it talks about thrones and judgment being given and the saints' reign. And I think that that's picked up also from Daniel 7. So it would seem logical if we're looking at Revelation 20 as the saints reigning, that if that's picked up from Daniel 7, that it's the same thing there.
Okay, that makes sense to me. Thank you. Those are both good contributions on this. Now let's look at the time prophecy itself. That's verse 25 and 26. And Shana, do you have that right in front of you? Okay, all right. And Lizette, I see you have your Bible open. Would you read those two? That would be Daniel 7. Verse 25 and 26.
He will speak against the Most High and oppress his saints and try to change the set times and the laws. The saints will be handed over to him for a time, times and a half a time. But the court will sit and his power will be taken away and completely destroyed forever.
Okay. Now we want to talk about that time, times, and half a time. And we're going to spend a little time on this. I know everybody knows this part, but we're going to spend a little time on this little time. Time, times, and a half, yeah. But this is such an important prophecy. It is the foundation of time prophecy. There's no question. It is the fundamental one. Does this time prophecy ever appear again in the book of Daniel?
Yeah.
It does? Where? In chapter 12, it does. So twice in the book of Daniel, we've got this time prophecy. The very fact that this time prophecy occurs twice in the book of Daniel is impressive to me. That means it should have some deep meaning. Now, here it's called time, times, and a half. In chapter 12, can somebody find the reference and tell me how it refers to it there?
Verse 7,
can you read that for us?
Daniel 12:7, it says, it's at the end of the verse there, it says, and I heard the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, when he held up his right hand and his left hand unto heaven, and swore by him that liveth forever and ever, that it shall be for a time, times and a half, and when he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people, all the things shall be finished. All these things shall be finished.
So we've got a time, times, and a half. Now, we know what a time is. That's going to be one. How many times should we allot for times?
Two.
That's the simplest possible answer. And you all know it's the right answer. Well, you know, when I was young, I said, okay, I did not that I disputed, but how do we know? How do we know? It could be 15. You know, how do we know? But this is a half. But if it is two, that means we have three and a half. So I'm going to ask you how we know how to deal with that as a period of time, as an overall arching period of time. Now, we have this twice in Daniel. Daniel 7, 25, and Daniel 12, was that 7?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, where else does this appear? It's not again in Daniel, just twice. Where else? Yes.
Revelation.
Let's find out where it is there.
So you have the 42 months. I mean, there's a number of
well,
them.
Let's find out the texts. Jeff?
Revelation 11, 2 and 3.
11, 2 and 3. How does it call it there?
1,203 score days, 1,260.
Does it call it something?
Oh, and also 42 months.
Okay, so there's two different references
right
there. Is that right? So in verse 2, what does it call it?
42 months.
42 months. And in verse 3?
1,260 days.
Okay. Where else does it appear?
Revelation 12:6.
12:6. What does it call it there?
1260 days.
1260. Where else does it appear?
12:14.
Where does it call it there?
Time, times, and a half a time.
And where else does it appear?
13, 5, and 8.
What does it call it there?
42 months.
You say 5 and 8?
Well, he's got, I copied from the internet, so just 5.
Oh, 5, okay.
And 42 it's months.
42 months. Okay. Now, this is what I say, this is the most fundamental time prophecy we've got. 7 times in Scripture it's repeated. This must be meaningful. And when you get to Revelation, where the church is being talked about, it's 5 times there. So I think this has to have some import to spiritual Israel, the church. And in these 7 times, we have enough diversity of expression so we can pin down that really is 3.5 times. So the times plural really means twice. Really means 2. Now let's figure this out. Let's see. If a time is a prophetic year, Lizette, how many months in a year are there? 12, okay. So in 2 years, how many months would you have? And in 3 years? Okay, doing good. Now, half a year more, 6 more months. 42, okay. So according to Lizette, as our authority here, we have 3.5 times would be the same as 42 months. I think she's come through for us because that's what Revelation 13:5 says, 42 months. So it's telling us we're on the right track. That tells us it really times was 2, not 15. And it tells us that, in fact, they're 12 months per year. Okay, now, next question is, how many days are in a month?
30.
And you all know that's supposed to be the right answer here, so we'll take that. But you could have said 28, you know. Maybe on leap year, 29. Or maybe sometimes 31. But you're all going to say 30. And that's what I would say, too. How do we know that we should multiply 42 months times 30 days per month to get the right answer? How do we know that? Maybe they're supposed to be lunar months. It should be 29.53. Well, I don't know. Shannon?
Gospel age sun.
Okay, we should be dealing not with lunar months then, but with solar. That's a very good approach. I think that's correct. But then should we use 30, 31, you know? Jeff?
This may be a simplistic answer, but it just works. 30 days per month, 42 months is 1,260 days, is 3.5 years. So.
Okay, if you multiply that out, you get 1,260. That's what you're saying?
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, two of the prophecies told us, if you haven't got it yet, it's 1,260. That's it. So that satisfies me.
We get it.
Okay, we get it. You know, you couldn't get it just from Daniel, though, could you? You really couldn't. You'd have all these nagging questions. But you can get it now that Revelation is written. And I don't think anybody could have pierced the meaning of this before that time. But now we can. Now we know that a prophetic year is 12 months times 30, 360. It's not 365 and a quarter for leap year and all that. You know, there's so many possibilities, but fortunately Revelation is very explicit. So it's a time prophecy given 7 times for us. It gives us enough diversity to absolutely figure out that it is 1,260 days. And a day represents a year. Now, I just said that glibly. A day represents a year, as we all know. How do we know that that's justified? Not that we dispute it, but you know, you want a foundation for these things. This is the foundational time prophecy of Scripture. Explain to me why we should say that's a period of 1260 years. Not everybody says that, you know. Why do we say that? What's the foundation, Jeff?
As you say often, because it works. No, no, Ezekiel.
The more you use that, the weaker it gets. Sometimes it's a default, yes.
Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6, where
okay.
Ezekiel was told to lay on his side.
Let me mark these down here. I'll put in a different
color. A day for a year.
Ezekiel 4, 6. Would you read that for us?
When you have completed these, you shall lie down a second time, but on your right side, and bear the iniquity of the house of Judah. I have assigned it to you for 40 days, a day for each year.
A day for each year. And then he goes on to so many more years, 390 on the other side, and each day is a year. So that's not bad. That's pretty good. That tells you that God sometimes works this way. It doesn't prove that he works that way here, but it's not bad. That's a pretty good. Any other cases where God has talked about a number of days that are fulfilled in a number of years? Anywhere else that happens other than Ezekiel?
Numbers.
Where's that?
I think it's chapter 14.
I think you're right. I'm
trying to find the verse.
Okay. Maybe 32 or 33. See if that's it, or maybe I'm thinking of something else. 34? Okay.
Yeah.
Who said that, 34? Oh, Carol, would you read that for us? Verse 34. Okay, that's a very good one. This is Numbers 14:34. Now, this is the occasion when the Israelites had sent spies into the land. How many spies did they send out? Estelle, do you recall? One for each tribe. That would be 12. That's it, 12. Not 12. How many came back with a good reply? How many came back with a bad reply? Two good ones and 10 bad ones. Okay. And the two good ones were Caleb and Joshua, and the other 10, you know, were not so good. So God said, well, since you don't want to go into the land, here's your punishment. How many days were you spying out the land? How many days were they spying the land? 40. So for every day, you're going to be wandering in the wilderness for a year. Now that, by the way, was retroactive. He started that from the beginning. I had a question about that. How do we know it wasn't 40 years from that point forward? Well, I won't go into all that, but you can prove it. It's very clear. So it's 40 retroactive. Carol, would you please? Mike?
After the number of the days in which ye searched the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, shall ye hear your iniquities, even 40 years, and ye shall know my breach of promise.
That's pretty clear. So there's two cases where we have a day for a year that God recognizes. Now, let me ask the next question. How do we know that in the prophecies of Daniel itself, neither of these are in the book of Daniel, how do we know that there, a day can represent a year? Brother Bill?
I think that's in, it's a little more obscure, but it's like in the 10th chapter. Is that what you're thinking of?
That isn't what I'm thinking about, but I'm interested to know what you have. Go ahead.
Well, there's the 10th chapter, there's verses 3 and 13. It says, I ate no pleasant bread, neither came flesh nor wine in my mouth, neither did I anoint myself at all till 3 whole weeks were fulfilled. And then the other one here talks about 21 days.
Okay, Bill, we're going to get into that when you get to the 10th chapter.
Okay.
But you're right. You're right, and I had forgotten about that in context of this. What Bill's saying is that those 21 days when Daniel was in prayer, waiting for a response, are going to end up maybe picturing 21 years of delay to his prayer about the building of the temple. Very good point. Bill, I'm glad you mentioned it. I forgot about that. I think that does show that Daniel himself, in the book of Daniel rather, this concept is utilized. Yes, Jackie?
And also there are some times when we know that concept does not work, and Jehovah, he will say,
40 days and 40 nights. In other words, he lets you know, no day for a year here, 40 days and 40 nights.
Okay.
He ends it to let you know that's literal.
That's a very intriguing approach, very intriguing. Now, anywhere else in Daniel that we can kind of have foundation for this? Yes.
Prophecy of the 70 weeks.
70 weeks, that's in Daniel chapter 9. 70 weeks of years is the way almost everybody takes it. Because you have to get from somewhere around Daniel's time, roughly, to Jesus' time. You can't do that by so many days. It's got to be a day for a year. Now, some actually think that 70 weeks is 70 sabbatical periods of 7 years apiece. So that would be intrinsically 7 years. Jeff?
It just surprises me that those who argue against the day for a year theory will at least agree that the Daniel 9 passage takes you to Christ. And
yeah.
They'll do a day for a year.
Everybody pretty much has to. So I think this is a good foundation. I'm glad that Brother Bill mentioned this because I forgot about that. That's another example intrinsic in Daniel. But it is interpretive. It's there. This one is very positive, the 70 weeks. And I think that's a very sterling foundation for the prophecy of the 1260 years. Daniel 9:24. Okay. So I think that's a good foundation. Now, if you want to know, where do we start the 1260 years of the papal dominion? Where do we start that? Randy? 539. That's the traditional date we use. I use it. But I want to ask the question, you know, it's traditional. You don't really, if a lot of people believe it, probably have some foundation for it. So you don't want to just wildly dispute something. But you do like to check the facts. What foundation is there for this period? Let's say we got the 1260 years down, but how do we know it really begins in 539 and it would end then? What year would it end with if it began there?
1799.
There you go, 1789. So we got to ask ourselves what kind of support we have. What's the foundation reasons for these dates? Because if you could convince a lot of Christians about this, boy, they'd be on the road to prophecy. Yes, Joyce.
In one of the early, I don't know, because I haven't looked at a recent Catholic version of the Bible, they began the little season of Satan's power in 1799. So the Catholics themselves recognized 1799 as the end.
Okay.
So we can always go backward and find the beginning.
Now, if you can find that reference at some point, I'd like to add it to my arsenal of notes up here. And in fact, I'm going to put it up there, just kind of a reminder to me. You say, little season, 1799, in their way of thinking, because it follows
the
thousand.
In a Douay version of the Bible, one of the older ones than what we have presently now, but it is in the Douay version of the Catholic Bible.
Okay.
In the commentary.
If you can ever, you know, pin that down with precision, I'd just love to know that. That would be very helpful. Randy, did you have your... Jeff.
Brother Russell had dated it a couple different ways. He also dated it 538 to 539. So if you look in
Brother Russell did. Are you sure he did?
Yes. When you look in... I just did a search here in the computer. I was surprised to find this out a couple months ago.
Okay, let's see. Where do you find
it? As late as reprint 5744, 4733 in the reprints.
Okay.
But he goes back and forth between 538 and 539.
Okay, I am surprised.
And he's relating it to the Pope being put in prison, like the Adventists do,
yeah,
on both ends of the 1260.
Now, the Adventists, as you know, use the date 538. And this was of interest to me. It would take you to 1798. And I was trying to figure out, okay, which of these years should we really be using? For sure. And now something Joyce said about 1799. What happened in 1799 that we sometimes look as a marker? What happened in that year?
Napoleon crowned himself.
All of those things happened about this time. None of those things happened in this year. French Revolution was literally in what year? 89, 10 years before this. It's in that period of time. Napoleon crowned himself in 1800-something. I don't know, 3, 4, 5, I don't know. Forget exactly.
Was the Pope taken prisoner in that year?
Pope was taken prisoner in 1798.
Yeah. He died in 1799.
He died in 1789. Sister Marge, what did you have on this?
I was going to say the same thing, that he died in prison in 1799, and this was the thing that really was convincing the people that the Pope didn't have power. The fact that he was taken prisoner, that could happen, he could get out. But when he died in prison, that was final.
Okay. Who was the Pope elected immediately after that Pope? I mean immediately. They didn't want time to pass without a Pope. Immediately, who was elected? You're all correct. No one. No one, because Napoleon refused to allow it. And he was in control by this time. Napoleon was not in control when they took him prisoner. That was under General Berthier, and it was somebody else was in charge. But by the time 1799 came, Napoleon is now in charge, and the Pope died a prisoner of Napoleon. And he says, I will not allow the election of a successor, because he wanted that power to be diminished with respect to his own authority and his own power. Now, Bill, you mentioned Napoleon having taken, you know, crowned himself and all that. It happened just a few years later. But that's, again, an example of how he wanted the papacy's power diminished. Now, at about 3 months later or so, another band of allies said, well, for a new pope. They allowed the election of a successor. But papacy briefly was headless during this time. They had no pope for about 3 months or so. And even a book that I have on my shelf at home on the popes of Rome show 1799 as the beginning of a new chapter, the end of one chapter, the beginning of a new. That's where they divide it, at the death of that pope. Now, in 539, what happened here? What happened in 538? I know we're a little over time. We'll finish this and then we'll stop. What happened in 538? What happened in 539? Get the history of this. Does anybody know? It's technical stuff. In 538, Jeff?
The details may be a little fuzzy, but in 536, Justinian, who was emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, sent his general Belisarius, who was a brilliant general, as far as generals go, and he invaded in 538. He besieged Ravenna, which was the capital of the Ostrogoths.
So far, so good. Won't get into that.
Okay.
Oh, hold on. 536, you're in good standing. By the way, it just turned out that in 1796 is when Napoleon came to the fore as a major force, political force and in general. So I think there's some connection between those two. Now, what happened in 538 was that Rome was being besieged. Rome, not Ravenna yet. Rome was besieged, and the Romans, with Belisarius, had the city. The people outside that were besieging it were the Ostrogoths. They had a huge force out there, and they were ready to take the city. And if they took the city, that would have been the end of this war, and the Ostrogoths would have won. Now, there was a divide in the empire at this time over a doctrine that we even discuss to this day. It was a division among Christians in the empire. What doctrine do you think that was?
Trinity.
It sure was. That was it. And guess what? The Ostrogoths, who were Christian nominally, you know, all these battles and wars, they're all Christian, you know. But nominally, they were Christian. And guess what side of the debate they were on? Arian. They didn't believe in the Trinity. And the Pope did. So the Ostrogoths are not going to be cooperative with the Pope. It's not going to connect well that way. The Ostrogoths, if they had won, would not have led to the Pope's primacy in the beginning of the 1260 days. But it's a remarkable that this 100,000 army of Ostrogoths out there, and they couldn't do anything. And the Romans inside the city kept sending little forays out and, you know, weakening the army out there. Finally, the Ostrogoths gave up and they left. And so now Belisarius in the city says, I got to go after these folks, take advantage of the opportunity. So he went out to punish them and, you know, to whip them, and they were on their way back to Ravenna or someplace else. And so he's got a problem now. He's leaving the city of Rome. Who is he going to put in charge of the city? He's got to find some trusted ally with authority they can leave the city of Rome in charge of. Who does he pick? You know how the story ends. It's a likely choice. He picks the Bishop of Rome as the Pope. And that's the first time he got authority politically in that respect. But in Italy, it was still governed by the Ostrogoths. What was the capital? Oh, Jeff, you had a comment first.
I was wondering if you're able to prove that from the history book. Do you have
I can,
history book quotes?
And I'll get to that in just a moment. 539, oh, excuse me, what was the capital of Italy at this time? It's not Rome, surprisingly.
Ravenna.
Ravenna. It was the capital of Italy. And this was the place you had to take if you're going to win the war. So the Ostrogoths were holed up there, and Belisarius came to that city, and he couldn't take the city. And so he made an agreement. And then after he was strong, he broke the agreement. He took over Ravenna, and he was successful. I think well of Belisarius usually, but this is a mark on him. It's just the way he operated. Yes, Paul?
An interesting thing about the Pope that died in prison, he was buried three times.
He was?
Yes. He was buried where he died, then he was moved to Rome, buried again, and then in 1949, he was dug up again and buried again in St. Peter's.
Oh, my goodness. I had no idea. What a reputation. Wow. Jeff.
That pope died in August 1799. The next pope was elected March 1800, on the 13th
March
of March.
So it was like 6 months then.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So 539 is when the city of Ravenna fell. And finally Justinian left with the spoils of war to go back to Constantinople. And so that's when the war was ended, and now the Ostrogothic power was broken. Now, they didn't lie over and turn over, and there was rebellions again and this and that. But 539 is when the capital of Italy fell. And now Italy is in the hands of Justinian, and he basically leaves the jurisdiction in the hands of the Pope. So if the Seventh-day Adventists choose 538 for Rome, we choose 539 for the fall of Ravenna. You know, I think we're right, but I still keep the other as an option. I think 539, and I'll tell you why, you know, as studies go on, why I think 539 has a greater attraction. Now, somebody asked where we can prove this. Okay, I would refer you to an issue of Beauties of the Truth, and this article, this is the foundational article, in my opinion, for this. It's called A Little Horn, or The Little Horn, one of those two. It was some years ago in Beauties of the Truth. It was composed by Brother Jerry Leslie. He goes through the whole detail of the history, every detail involved here, and I think he tells us these are the right dates when those things happened. Now, how do we know the history of that time? There is one book, one author that tells us, and that's it, and his name was Procopius. Procopius was a historian that was the resident historian for the general Belisarius. Who mentioned Belisarius? Was that Jeff? Belisarius was the general that Justinian appointed to free Rome. And Belisarius already was a general of great accomplishments. And as a consequence, he had a historian assigned to him to note everything that's going on. And Procopius wrote a large history of the wars by which Rome was taken back to Justinian. And it's his account blow by blow that we have available today. Jim Parkinson got a set of those books, because it's more than one book, and he sent them to me. And you have Greek on one side, and you have the English translation on the other side, and this is the original works of Procopius. So I went through that with a fine-tooth comb in the English version, of course. And I enjoy getting all the facts straight. Jerry Leslie got wind of it, so we sent the books to him, and he read through it and wrote this article on the Little Horn. Jim Parkinson has a set of those books. I have a set of those books, and Jim has gone through them as well. So I think we've got this on a pretty good foundation, Jeff, for this point. So I think we're in good foundation here, and anybody can read those details who wishes to. And it was 538 that the siege of Rome, and then 539 the fall of Ravenna. I think that's where you're going, to the fall of Ravenna, and that was 539. Yes.
Brother Jim gave us one of the books. I mean, it's not easy to go through that. I mean, what did you find when you went through it? I mean, Shane and I, we pored over these paragraphs and we're looking and we're going, you know, I mean,
I just want to make that comment. It's not the easiest thing to go through those books and get those dates.
Right, it's not. What Jerry has done is give you all the factual details that he gleaned from those books. You can check the books out. You can check by what his facts are. Find a disparity. You know, don't make me the last to know. But I've gone through it, and I'm satisfied that he's got it correct. That's my opinion. Now, yes.
So what year did he leave and turn the power, you know, turn the city over to the Bishop of Rome? What year was that? Where does that fall in there?
538 is when Belisarius left Rome and gave the keys, as it were, to the Pope. That's why Seventh-day Adventists like that date. 539 is when Ravenna fell, and now the wars ended, at least temporarily, before a later rebellion. So that's why other people like 539, because that's a more decisive time. If you bring down the thread of history, 1798 is when the Pope was taken prisoner out of Rome. Kind of an interesting parallel. 1799 is when the thing was a fait accompli. He died, and there was no successor. So you've got the same question here as you do here. You got Belisarius, the war started here. You got Napoleon coming to power here. And there's more. 533 is when Justinian made a decree that the Pope would be recognized as the head of Christian churches. 1793 is when the French Parliament passed a law that abolished Christianity, by which they had in mind papacy, but they didn't distinguish. So there's a whole series of dates that are kind of in parallel here. And 540 BC is when Belisarius left and went back to Rome for the laurels of victory. And 1800 BC is when the next episode began, and another pope was reelected, but without the power of the old pope. So I guess you could say, in a way, there's a 7-year parallel, you know, in the whole thing. So it's not just a single year, but that's the year, I think, is the crucial year. Now, we're over time here. I'm going to stop here.
We got half an hour, my wife said.
Oh, we do? Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Real quick, could you repeat what happened in 533? I didn't catch that.
533. You'll find this in the third volume. You see a lengthy quote, in fact, in Latin, in the footnote, where Justinian gives the Pope the authority to be recognized as the head of all Christian churches. Now, you know, there's another gentleman that would have been interested in that privilege. Constantinople is what, over here somewhere? And there was the patriarch of Constantinople that said, you know, I kind of like that job myself. But Justinian said, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to give it to the Bishop of Rome, because I need that political alliance on my side. And he didn't say all that, but, you know, I'm reading between the lines here. but there was another. Thank you. This is one of the set of books. And you'll see here, you've got the Greek on one side, you've got the English on the other. So people like Giselle can read the Greek, and I'll read the English. But it is. I'm glad you read it. I'm glad you got through it. Check Jerry's article and see if you can find that series of
things. I didn't know Jerry wrote an article on it, so that'll help.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Are these archived where you can get a copy?
They are. They are on the internet under beautiesofthetruth.org, and you can go back and see any number you want. And if you can't find the one you want, email Richard Doctor, and he'll tell you where to look. Yes. Is it what? It's a
June
1981.
But it says contributed.
Well, it was contributed by Jerry Leslie. I know. I know. Yes.
I just did an observation.
At that time, Jerry was managing editor, and I think in humility he said contributed, but I don't think it's because he was ashamed of his findings or anything like that. Sometimes people just don't want their name on that article, on that publication, but not him. That was different.
Yeah. I'm astounded by the fact that the Pope actually began a kingdom of 1,000 years, all planned for by our Heavenly Father. But he didn't receive it in strength. He received it by default, as the only one there who they thought could manage things.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
And it's a reflection on the whole period of 1,000 years, too.
Yeah. Now, the reason I took quite a bit of time on this time prophecy is because it is the foundational time prophecy How many other time prophecies are there in Daniel? Let me just ask you to tell me, what are the time prophecies you can think of in the book of Daniel? We've got the 1260. Let me make a list of them here. 1260. What other time prophecies are there? 70 weeks. So I'm going to say that's 490, okay? I'll put that up here, 490. 2520. I don't mind a 2500 because I use that as a, you know, a span, but I don't think it's right in Daniel itself.
1290.
1290. Okay, so we got a series of five time prophecies in the book of Daniel. 2300. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Now, we haven't got to Daniel, the ninth chapter yet. We'll get there. But I just want to put all these on the board. We have six time prophecies. Yes?
Daniel 10. 21 days.
21 days. That's good. That's good. But you know, it's not explicit. Then I get seven. Okay, that's good. All right, I'll put that down. 21. Now we got seven. Okay. But probably most people will say, you know, maybe, maybe not. You know, sure. So we got at least six that are very, very explicit. Now, the reason I list these is because I think we can put a date to each one of these, and I'm going to erase from this compendium from my, because we'll get to Daniel chapter 9 later. We'll get there. But I'm going to erase that one right there because it takes you to the first Advent, not the second Advent. And I'm going to erase this one here because it's different. And not because I dispute either one of them, but I think these five are the ones that deal with the approaching period of the end of the gospel age. So let's look at all these and let's find a date for each one. Now, what date does the 1260 years end in? That should be an easy one. It's already up there. 1789. And what about the 1290 days? What date would that end? Well, let's see. The 1290, pretty much everybody says, starts at the same time. So when would that end? 1829. Okay. And then we have the 1335. 1874. Okay. So that's a little triplet of prophecies that are all connected. So I guess we could say then, fill in this as 1829, and fill in this as 1874. When do the 2520 times of the Gentiles end? We already talked about that. 1914. And the 2300 days. When do those end? When do you say? We'll get into that a little later, but now let's pick a date. Sometimes brothers say 1846. I personally, when did William Miller think that happened?
First he thought 1843, then he thought 1844.
1840, he always thought, actually, that it was 1843. He thought maybe the grace period was a year. Yeah. God was just very generous to linger, give another year to go. But he always said 1843. I want to get to the eighth chapter, Daniel. We'll talk about that. I think he's right. I don't use 1846. I think it's 1843. But just for a moment, let's just plug in his date there. And now I want to ask the question, is there any way to kind of dovetail to see that we're on the right track, approximately at least, with these dates? And for that, we're going to have to go into the book of, into the experiences of Elijah. Now, I want to wait. I want to do that this afternoon. I think our minds need a break. It's too thick. It's too much detail. I think we're going to pause here. Yeah. And we're going to have lunch in a few minutes, but we'll have a little fellowship before then. So I'll just turn it back to to Brother Bill and